Last year, an honors seminar at the University of Iowa called The Green Room helped students find direction and connect to the community. This year, the whole community has been invited into the classroom. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. I'll talk to Dave Gould, the man behind the Green Room, and magician Nate Staniforth, one of the featured speakers. Later in the hour, we all know that kids are spending more and more time with screens these days, but the location of those screens might be as significant as the amount of time they're spending with them. I'll talk with psychologist Doug Gentile about the dangers of allowing media into your children's bedrooms. Join the conversation after the news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Find your passion and follow it. That sounds like great advice, but it's a lot easier said than done. And there's an honors seminar at the University of Iowa that's designed to help students figure out their passion, what they want out of life after college. It's called the Green Room. And one of the innovative parts of the class is that members of the community are invited to join as well. Last year's class was so popular that it got a lot bigger this year. 80 students and literally hundreds of community members in Iowa City have been taking part. Dave Gould is the administrator for the Bell and Blank Center for Gifted Education and Talent Development at the University of Iowa, and he is the man behind the Green Room. He is with me now. Hello, Dave.
Hello. Nice to be here.
Well, thank you so much for coming back. And we've talked about the Green Room before, but I want you to give it to me in a nutshell. What was the idea, the kernel of the idea that started this?
Well, the idea, the kernel came from a mission statement in the honors program. If you go into the Bell and Blank Center and ride the elevator, you'll see almost a full-size wall of the mission statement for the honors program at the University of Iowa, which includes a line about self-discovery. And I think to the credit of the honors program, they took a pause and they realized they were doing a terrific job of helping students find research opportunities. They were doing a terrific job of helping students find scholarships and grants and all those kind of wonderful things. But the notion of using this time to really take a pause and to think about who they want to be, what they want to do, how they participate as a citizen, that was something that that they felt they were lacking. And so I got asked to see if I could create something around that, and that became the Green Room. And as you said, we met last fall, very small group, about 30 students. We did that deliberately. The students would curate the class. I brought thought leaders in, all bringing an individual question about what their life up to that moment had informed by, and what they believed that 20-something should be struggling with in higher education, should be helping to strengthen. And the students curated the classes. We ate dinner together. All of those kind of wonderful, intimate, community-building types of things. But again, it was just 30 students.
Right. And now, you brought in thought leaders, mm-hmm. but also other members of the community were invited into that classroom as well.
Well, in the fall, and this has always been, quite honestly, a practice of any class I've had, I have an open door policy, right? So in the fall, what I did is somebody said, could I bring my roommate? Could I bring my girlfriend, boyfriend? My mom and dad are in town. And that's where it started. And by the time we got through, it was an 8-week course. By the time we got through the 8 weeks, we had as many community members that were following the course as were students in the class. And we would have a practice at the start of every class of just asking who was visiting us and finding out who was in our midst and then encouraging them to meet with my students and to have this kind of collision of town and gown.
All right. Now things are a lot different this year. It was a big success. And the university asked you if maybe you could include a few more students, right?
Yeah. They wanted to expand it. I wasn't quite ready to take it up over 100, and so we arrived at about 80. Interestingly enough, half of the initial class has come back as TAs. So an idea of giving back. So we got 13, 14 students that took it the first time that are now helping to lead teams of the other students. But to your point, I realized that I was not going to be able to have the same type of a design and model. So, you know, so it's going to be bigger. And there's pros to that and there's cons to that. And one of the things is my kind of, I guess my imagination started kind of moving forward was I've been interested in community. I've been interested in how, and when I say community, I mean students and residents, what makes up our town. And I'm very interested in how communities become smarter, how they use that knowledge then to inform not only our own personal lives, but our neighbors and those that are most vulnerable among us, and how potentially you could uplift a community through education. And so the idea then became, let's find the biggest community place that we could find, let's move my class there, and then let's invite the whole city to join us.
All right, so you moved it to the Englert Theater, a historic theater in downtown Iowa City, and you said, hey, everybody come. And you put together a lecture series of, you know, individuals coming in to speak to your class, but also to speak to the community. Tell me about the idea behind this kind of setup, to bring in these individuals. Some of them are local, some of them are not.
Yeah, and so for starters, it's that's just one layer of it. Mm-hmm. The students arrive at about 5:30 on a Monday night, and they meet in teams, and they talk about every week the teams have assignments from reaching into pockets of our community of people who might not be included. So these could be international students on our campus or pockets of our Iowa City community. The students act as greeters. The students, one team will promote it. One team is our roadies that are working the lights and actually stage managing it. And then there's a team that produces every one of the classes. At 6 o'clock, the guests, but when I say the guests, the thought leader, but it's also the musicians, it's also the local nonprofit that we tie to every evening, they all come up on stage with my students, and we have a conversation about not only do we want to accomplish and what we're trying to do for the evening, but an opportunity for my students to actually kind of curate the night with the guests that we have. Doors open at 6:45, and the community comes in. And from 7 to 8:30, that is a more standard type of a classroom situation, though it is totally run by my students and have those different layers. I mentioned the local nonprofit. We tie a local nonprofit that works within the space of the topic of the night. And the idea behind that is so often these traditional lecture series is you go to them, you get inspired, but then you come home and maybe you buy the book and keep it going for a little longer, but without a place to plug it in, it just naturally dissipates. And so the idea is, how can you become inspired and excited, and how can we then show you in our own community where this kind of work is being done and give you opportunities when it calls to you that you're part of it. So we have a community table that is also set up at the end. So, so think of it like a rock show. We have a main speaker who comes, who draws a crowd. We have the opportunity to then use that for opening acts. And for that could be a local nonprofit. That could be some work. My students are doing a fundraiser right now for the hurricane victims. And so that was totally created out of the students in the class. And then finally at 8:30, we move to the Merge, which is really about, for those who don't know Iowa City, about a half a block from the Englert Theater. They open their doors, another community space, and we continue the conversation in a much more informal way. And I have a group of students who run that space as well.
All right. And this series of thought leaders, individuals that you are bringing in, did you put that together on your own? I mean, this happened, of course, before the semester, and some of these people probably were pretty difficult to book.
You had to. Yeah. You had to. That's the only thing that came prepackaged. I had to start on that in the spring. And if you look at the list, I mean, number one, I think they all are thought leaders and all wonderful folks. And it's always a balance between me. I have collected wonderful, interesting, inspiring people, and I tried to turn them into my friends. And so there's a handful of these people that are familiar to Iowa City, whether they live here, whether they are a former student of mine, or they've come here often. And then I always have three or four in the mix that I've never met. I've never sometimes even talked to, but that I have an instinct, a feeling that they have something interesting to say. And then for me, in a way, that same adventure, that same journey that my students are going through, I also go through as well. Because a lot of this, I mean, Englert Theater is 700 seats. On our first night, there was no guarantee that anyone was going to come. We had no publicity budgets or anything like that. So you got a class of 80, put my TAs on that 90 people. my running joke was, we might have a lot of leg room, and and that's got to be okay. So it was all done. All of that was done in advance, but my students, once they hit town, they get meals for them, they greet them, they meet them, they write thank you notes. I mean, all of that process is done with my students.
Well, tell me about some of the people that you brought in. We're going to talk to Nate Staniforth in just a few minutes, a magician who lives in Iowa City.
One of my favorites for sure.
And but give us an idea of the mix of people you
brought
in.
Yeah, we started with Zach Walls, who was actually a student of mine here at the university. I knew Zach as a freshman, sophomore, and those who are familiar with Zach's story and his trip to the Iowa legislature, the issue of same-sex marriage that kind of vaulted him into a national spotlight, you know, from the speech he gave to a book to the Democratic National Convention. And so Zach came, and Zach is at Princeton right now. He's in graduate school and actually comes from the Honors Program. So that was a very fitting one to start. He talked about the issue of homelessness as was his issue. Nate was our next one up, and you'll get to hear more from him, but a dear friend and really a thought leader and a magician. And then we just recently had Lisa Lucas, who is the executive director of the National Book Award. Jane Elliott, who, if you remember, the brown-eyed, blue-eyed exercise, who's now 85 years old and just a spitfire of a woman.
Right, and if you don't know about Jane Elliott, we have had her on River to River, and you should go back and listen to our interview with her because she's extraordinary.
She is extraordinary. I mean, as she is the only one so far. I guess Nate would be another, but totally no notes, just totally an hour and a half of just standing on a stage and just talking to 700 people. We have Mr. Kahn, if you remember the Kahn parents from the Democratic National Convention, will be coming in this Monday. Peter Aguero from the Moth, the Grand Slam storytelling champ. And that is the public group. And then my students will gather again in the very last class at a homestead farm. And Dan Lerner, who you are also familiar with from a past person on Iowa Public Radio, teaches the Science of Happiness class. We will have a gathering that will just be then privately for my students to close this out.
So the students meet on Monday nights. I mean, it sounds like that's a really long chunk of time. Do they meet outside of that as well?
Well, they do, but it's voluntary. So the class is a two-semester-hour class. That's the amount of time that a class is supposed to be. So we have no dress rehearsals. It's really on the fly. But these are committed, bright young people. My TAs have a breakfast club, but we meet at 10 o'clock every morning. The students who are producing their teams will often meet during the week. But no, it's a one-night class.
All right. Well, we'll talk more about what you've experienced so far this semester and what the students are taking away from that as well. We're also going to have Nate Staniforth in the conversation here in just a moment, an Iowa City-based magician who was one of the featured speakers in the Green Room this year. These lectures going on at the Englert Theater in Iowa City, and obviously a lot going on outside of that interaction as well. Dave Gould is here with me. He's the administrator for the Bell and Blank Center for Gifted Education and Talent Development at the University of Iowa. He is the man behind the Green Room. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. And then coming up later this hour, new research about some concerns about having a television or a video game system in a child's bedroom. I'll talk with psychologist Douglas Gentile from Iowa State University later in the hour. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We're talking about the Green Room. It's an honors seminar at the University of Iowa designed to help young people find direction, to connect with the community and figure out what they want out of life after college. It started last year. This year, it's a lot bigger than it was last year, and the entire community has been invited into the classroom. So there are about 80 students involved, and then every Monday night for the last few weeks, there's been a featured speaker at the Englert Theater in downtown Iowa City, and anyone who wants to come and be a part of this has been welcome to come. Dave Gould is here with me. He's the administrator for the Bell and Blank Center for Gifted Education and Talent Development at the University of Iowa. He is the man behind the Green Room. And we've been talking about some of these featured speakers in the Green Room. Nate Staniforth has been one of them. He is an Iowa City-based magician and participated in the Green Room this semester. Nate, thank you so much for being here.
Sure. Thank you for having me on.
So when Dave came to you and asked you to be a part of this, I'm curious, what was his pitch? What did he say you were going to be doing?
It was very simple. I want to invite the whole community to college. So will you come give a talk? And it'll be for my students, but it'll also be for anyone else in the community who wants to come.
And what was your reaction?
I have learned to just say yes whenever Dave asked me to do something. So I didn't think about it for very long.
All right. Nate's a magician. You say he's also a thought leader. So what made you think, we need Nate Staniforth to come and be a part of this?
Well, and I've known Nate now. He's one of those that I collected as a friend. I knew him. I observed him, I should say, as a student here at the University of Iowa, and I followed him and gradually talked him into coming into my very first class, which was probably, 6-7 years ago, and have realized the magic that I used that pun intentionally that he has with my students. Why do I see Nate as a thought leader? Well, the magic is wonderful, right? But there is really, and this is my words, Nate can speak for himself, but there's so many much more levels to it. Nate's interest is to kind of jog us out of this kind of apathy for life. We're born, anyone who's got young kids or could even remember being one knows the kind of sense of wonder that childhood has. It's the way we're wired. And so the ability to kind of hang on to that as the weight of the world begins to press down on us, which is becomes harder and harder to do with busier and busier harried lives, that is really, I think, in my mind, really the fundamental idea behind the creation of Nate's magic. It's to jog us out of that. It's not that he is trying to fool us. It's that he is trying to help us think of the world differently. And so when Nate is with my students, the magic is a way that catches their attention. But I believe it's the words and the things that he teaches that truly has some resonance moving forward.
Well, and Nate, as a magician, you have observed that a lot of people think that magicians are for children, but you observed along the way as a performer that it really was adults that really seemed to catch onto your show and become more fascinated and really light up because of it. What have you seen?
Well, so I grew up in Ames, Iowa, and one of the advantages of that is as a young magician, I was the only act in town. So if the Boy Scouts wanted a magician, I was their guy. If their parents, if parents wanted a magician for their child's birthday party, I was literally the only option. And so I started performing at birthday parties from age 11, on. And I noticed very quickly that parents would bring me in anticipating that the children would like the magic. But invariably, it was the grown-ups in the back of the room watching who responded with the most depth and emotion. And it felt like, magic was most powerful for people who had lost it somehow. And that, figuring out what that loss was, that fascinated me far more than any interest in show business.
That is so interesting because children, there's a window, at least, when most kids believe in magic, and we encourage that,
right,
as their parents. I'm not going to talk about what we say that encourages their belief in magic, but I think most of us in the Christian culture have embraced at least one magical being that we try to keep alive in our children's minds. So kids, magic seems pretty natural to them, but as adults, a lot of us have lost that.
Right, and that's the question. What is it that we lose with age, and how do you get it back?
But you know that the adults know that what you're doing isn't technically magical.
Right, and in the same way that when you go to Peter Pan and you watch that play, you know that they're actors, right? No one leaves that show saying, boy, that was fun, but I don't think those were real pirates, That's not the point, right? The playwright is communicating something to us that's far greater than the deception that's inherent to the medium. And I think the mistake that magicians have made, over the past 100 years, 200 years, is focusing on the deception, right? That's not the goal. The goal isn't to fool the audience. That's just sort of assumed that you will do that. The real power comes from using that to give them something real that resonates on a human level rather than just as entertainment.
So in igniting that sense of wonder or reintroducing that sense of wonder, how does that connect outside of the theater, outside of the magic show?
Sure. Nobody cares. I mean, if we're honest, nobody cares about magic tricks. But everybody cares about wonder, right? We can all, and you can find it anywhere. You can find it in movies or music or basketball or poetry or the night sky or barbecue. Like, it's more about how you look rather than where you look, right? And all of us, I think, can remember a moment in our lives that have felt magical, whether it's being with friends, whether it's seeing the ocean for the first time. And I don't know if this has been your experience, but it absolutely has been mine that as I get older, that becomes harder and harder to find, right? It's cynicism is easy, right? Certainty is very seductive. It's much easier to live as if you've been there and you've done that and to sort of calcify that part of your spirit that is open to the experience of wonder. And there are a lot of good reasons. Like, it's hard to be alive in the world, right? But my favorite moments are those that shock me out of that sort of complacency and sort of drag me out to say, you know, wake up, open your eyes. There's more to it than that.
It strikes me that in our culture, we actually actively discourage that sense of wonder, especially, I think, in male culture. I mean, we kind of make fun of people who have that, we would call it maybe naivete.
Right.
Is that something that you feel yourself pushing back against?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not from any sort of moral agenda, but just in my own experience, my favorite moments of being alive, if I'm honest, have nothing to do with any sort of victory or accomplishment. Like, that's more the result of life than the purpose of it, right? But it's those moments that just take my breath away, you know? And I will find that experience anywhere I can. And the thing you learn as a magician is that one of the best ways to feel wonder for yourself is to give it away, to share it with other people. You know, you mentioned how parents sort of encourage a belief in magic through any number of characters.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't do that to fool their children, right? They do it to enchant them.
Right.
And in doing so, you learn how it feels to give someone that experience of wonder.
I'm talking with Nate Staniforth. He is an Iowa City-based magician and one of the featured guests in the Green Room this semester, a University of Iowa honors seminar. And part of course, this honors seminar, the whole idea is to help young people try to figure out what they want out of life after college. And Nate, you started doing magic when you were 8 years old. You performed as a magician, but you grew up. You went to college. Was there a lot of pressure on you to give up the magic and figure out something a little more practical to do with your life?
Yeah, it's adorable as a 9-year-old when you say you're going to be a magician. It's less adorable when you say that as a 19-year-old and you
right.
really believe it, you know?
So, yeah.
So, you know, I think that's a challenge that many college students face, right? It's one thing to have a dream. It's another to have a plan. And how do you cross that bridge from wanting to be something to actually making it happen? And, you know, that's why I think classes like the Green Room are so important, because you can't teach anyone how to do it, but you can show students how other people have done
right.
it and give them the tools to figure it out.
What gave you what you needed to push on through and say, yeah, this is actually my career. This is what I'm going to do with my life? Because I'm sure there were some lean times as a magician.
Yeah, stubbornness and fear are pretty great motivators. You know, I think once you know this is what I want to do, you sort of have a responsibility to chase it, right? And so, you know, you've heard of Malcolm Gladwell's 10,000 hours, right? I hit that the summer I turned 22. So I was sort of a strange little kid. I didn't.
And for people who haven't heard 10,000 hours, the idea is that's the amount of hours of practice that
right.
you need to really become a professional at something or to become an expert.
Right. And so, you know, in the way that some children latch on to football or video games, like for me, it was practicing magic. And I just wanted to take that. I've never wanted to do anything else. I've just been chasing it as hard as I can for longer than I can remember.
So before you gave your talk at the Englert Theater, you spent some time with Dave's students, with the seminar students. What was that time like?
I found that there was a great interest from them. They didn't care about my magic tricks at all, but they were very curious to hear how someone could take a career aspiration as obscure as wanting to become a professional magician from Iowa and make that a reality. Because none of them want to be magicians, but all of them have their own hopes, whether it's to become a writer or to start a business or to go on to grad school or become a you know everyone mm-hmm. has their own thing that they're chasing. And I think, you know, when I think back on the questions that they asked before my lecture, they were all about how do you take an aspiration and turn it into a reality? Because whatever they're hoping for, it's not stranger than becoming a professional magician.
Did you leave Iowa for a time to pursue being a magician?
I did, yeah. I thought in order to do this job, I had to live in a big city. So I moved to Los Angeles and then to Chicago. But I started traveling so much for work. I would just go out on tour doing shows that when I was home, I wanted it to really feel like home. And one of the incredible things about Iowa is that it's an amazing arts town, sort of, you know, in an unexpected part of the world. And I love that I can live here most of the time, and then when I'm working, go out on tour, and it works. It's okay.
So did any of the students ask about that? Because you've made a very conscious decision based on a desire for a certain quality of life. Did any of the students ask you about that? Like, why are you here?
Yeah, it didn't come up, but it has come up in other classes that I've done with Dave. Because mm-hmm. I think there's a perception, especially in creative fields, that you have to live in a big city. And my experience has been that you don't, first of all. And second of all, I do better work here. I like being able to, you know, leave my house and walk through the forest and sort of get away from everything. And you have to wear the suit that fits. And I think some people really thrive in city life, and I thrive here. This is where I do my best work. And
did you have to leave to figure that out, do you think?
Yeah. Oh, of course. And you know, going on tour teaches you a number of things, but one of those things is how nice Iowa is, because it's just, it's chaos. It's bedlam, and this is not.
So the idea is that your students and the public will spend time with Nate, and they'll listen to him talk, and they'll see his magic tricks, and that sense of wonder gets ignited. But you don't want it to end at the end of that evening, Dave. So what do you want to happen next?
Well, that's a good question. And in some respects, it's not totally for me to answer. It's the students and community that will tell me. My students every week assign community homework. And this is my students creating whatever kind of the subject matter of the night might be, assignments that have a low bar threshold so everybody can participate. But it's the idea of bringing the community into a conversation. In 2017, we're using social media in the biggest of ways. My students manage that, and those are ways that we're trying to create dialogue and trying to learn. My students will survey the community as they're coming into the theater and at the merge at the end of the night, and begin to ask them questions about how we can do this better, but also what they're thinking and what's important to them, so that we can begin to learn. This is like jazz. This is improvisation. It's an idea. You take a leap, and every week I'm learning as much as my students. But the idea about how higher education can be more meaningful and community engaged is really at the heartbeat of what I think I'm trying to do. And you know, and I think that, my gosh, if you heard Nate just a second ago, I mean, to keep that selfishly only for my students seems a waste. And to not be able to bring it out and open it to others, that seems to be the future. So anyhow, that's my hope.
With the students' questions, what has your observation been over the weeks? Because you've talked about the incredible variety of people that you are bringing together, you know, one week after another. These are people with very different paths. What do you find the students focus on?
Well, the nice thing is they are absolutely different paths with different topics and different. I mean, you got somebody like Nate talking about wonder, followed by somebody like Jane Elliott talking about anti-racism. I mean, mm-hmm. they really do run the gamut. If you asked me how I will measure success, it's a ladder. First is, will they come? Will people put their bodies in seats on a Monday night when they're tired after work, and will they listen to the folks that are coming? And then, going up, do they have what a colleague of mine calls a church-like high? Are they inspired by what they hear? And then, moving up another notch, does that stay with them? Does it sustain? Do the questions that they heard and the things that they ask themselves, does that carry on for a few days? And then ultimately, do they do something with it? Does it move them into action? And that's really absolutely what the end product is, because if it's just a Monday night to bring somebody that you find interesting, you go home, you change the channel the next morning and move on, then this is a lot of work for not much payoff. But I believe education in the world we live in can truly play a special role. The first thing I said on the very first day of class is that in a world that seems very divided, that we often don't talk to people outside of our own little sphere, that I believe that the classroom can really be a place of magic. It could be the classroom is a sacred spot where we all come in as learners. And sometimes it just makes my conviction stronger. I listen and hear these things. I weigh them openly, and I feel more strongly committed to what I'm doing. Sometimes I begin to see the world in shades of gray instead of just black and white. And every now and then, my paradigm shifts, and I start to see the world anew. And that's the hope, and that's what education is.
This is the second year for the Green Room. You've got to be, in some ways, still in kind of an experimental stage. Mm-hmm. Do you have ideas for how you'd like to do things differently next year, if you do it again next year?
Well, like I said, the community and the students will tell me. The one thing I think I will do is we're going to bring the community back together to talk about the experience, and I'm going to listen to them, and I think I'm going to create one new Green Room in the spring, which won't be my class, but it will include my students, that they won't know until they show up. It'll be based on what they tell me.
All right. Well, Dave Gould, thank you so much.
Thank you. I'm honored to be here.
Dave Gould, the man behind the Green Room. He's the administrator for the Bell and Blank Center for Gifted Education and Talent Development at the University of Iowa. Nate Staniforth, thank you so much.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
Nate Staniforth is an Iowa City-based magician and one of the featured speakers in the Green Room. There are two events left in this series. You can find out more online. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It shouldn't come as a surprise that kids these days are spending more and more time with screens. But the location of those screens might be almost as significant as the amount of time kids are spending with them. Douglas Gentile is a professor of psychology at Iowa State University and the lead author of a new study that gives us some insight into the consequences of allowing children to have a TV or video game system in their bedroom. And Doug is with me now. Hello, Doug.
How are you doing?
Great. So when you started this study, what was the main question you were seeking to answer?
Well, I've often asked for the past 20 years worth of studies whether kids have a TV in their bedroom or a video game system in their bedroom. And every time we've looked at that question, it has shown, you know, a significant relation with almost anything we've measured, whether that's school performance or aggressive behavior or even things like addictive behaviors. And so it was clear it's important, but it's difficult to figure out why it's important. Why would where you place the media matter? And we've had ideas about it, such as, well, maybe having a TV in the bedroom might decrease school performance not because of what it's doing, but because of what the kids aren't doing. Mm. They're maybe doing less homework or less reading or getting less sleep. And so it's displacing other things. And displacing something is really hard to measure because you're trying to measure something that didn't happen. And what this study does is it finally figures out how to do that.
So just before we dive into what you did found, how common is it for kids in 2017 to have a television or a gaming system in their bedroom?
Yeah, I don't have the most recent statistics, but a few years ago it was about 30% of babies had TVs in their bedrooms, over 40% of preschoolers, and about over 70% of 8 and up. And that's probably a low number compared to now.
Wow. So it is it's a really common behavior.
Yeah.
And the stuff that's easier to measure, not the positives, but the things that increase when a child has a television or a gaming system in their bedroom, I mean, how does that affect the amount of time they spend with their screen, because we see screen time growing among all kids.
Yeah. Well, and you're right. Every time we measure it, we think, oh, it can't get higher. And it continues to get higher. And I think that's partly because of the proliferation of screens. We're not just talking about television anymore, or even television and video games, or even television and computers. But now we have handheld video games and Netflix and iPads and iPhones and so many more screens surrounding kids. And when you add them all up, that number has grown to over 50 hours a week. The average American school-aged child is spending with screen.
50 hours a week, so more than a full-time job they're spending with
their screen. About 54 hours a week by my most recent estimates.
Oh, that's incredible. And so when a kid has a TV or a gaming system in their bedroom, are they on average spending more than...
It goes up even more, okay. Yeah. So this study didn't look at the data that way, but in some other studies we've done, basically, if you look at the average amount of time a kid spends with television, the average kid is about 31 hours a week with TV and DVDs nowadays. And you can add on about another 8 hours to that per week if there's a TV in the bedroom.
Now, one of the things that you found in this study, that it changes the kinds of content that a child engages with if they have that television or video game system in their bedroom. What does it change?
Well, we didn't measure all the ways it might change it, but we did look specifically at whether they're consuming violent media. And if the TV or video game system's in their bedroom, then their media violence exposure increases, as well as the amount of time they're just spending with them. And so it's not really changing the main effect. What it's changing is the how strong that effect is, because basically it's adding, you know, a turbocharger to effects that already happen from the amount of time kids spend with screens or the types of things they watch.
Okay, so if my child is spending screen time in the living room and he or she knows what my basic rules are for what they should or should not be watching, they're probably going to follow those rules. But if they're in the bedroom, all bets are off.
Yeah, and we found this in another national study some years ago, that when kids have a TV in the bedroom, those parents are less able to have consistent rules in their household for children's use of media. The parents are able to monitor less what the kids are seeing or hearing if the media are in the bedroom. The kids participate in fewer alternative activities to electronic media. So they have fewer hobbies, they play fewer sports, they go to the library less, they read less. And, you know, maybe we don't really care too much about that, but they also get worse grades in school if they have a TV in the bedroom, and their risk of obesity goes up 31% just by virtue of putting it in the bedroom. So parents lose a lot of the control once the media become privatized. Even if you think you've got good rules for the house, once it's in their bedroom, it's harder to maintain those rules.
Now, so far we've talked about televisions and video game systems, which are getting to be obsolete. So, you know, our kids have iPads or Android devices or whatever. They've got these handheld devices, and it's really easy to carry one of those devices into a bedroom. Are you
right,
including those kinds of devices in this description of the media that kids have in their bedrooms?
I think yes. Now, we didn't study that. We didn't ask those questions in these studies, but there's no reason to believe that those would be somehow different, except for the fact they actually magnify this effect, most likely, because then you've got 24-hour access in your pocket, basically.
The kinds of media that kids access with those devices, again, I mean, that would shift from place to place. If my kid is watching one of these devices or playing with one of these devices in the living room, chances are pretty good that their rules, the rules that would govern what they engaged with in their bedroom, would shift just by taking that walk down the hallway and shutting the door, right?
Yeah, if they're not worried about you walking behind them and seeing what they're looking at, they might see things that, you know, you would otherwise comment on. And so, even though the media keep changing, and parents often say, oh, you know, it's, you know, we don't really know whether this has much of an effect because it's so new, there hasn't been study on it, or maybe it changes it. We haven't been finding that in the research, that each new medium comes along as the studies get done. It seems to show pretty much the same types of effects as the last ones, that, and they seem to boil down into a couple pretty basic dimensions. How much time kids spend with them has a wide range of effects, and we see that in terms most clearly with, say, school performance, with sleep, with physical health, with what's being called video game addiction. Those seem to be related most directly to the amount of time kids spend with media. And it almost doesn't matter which medium it is or which screen they're looking at. We seem to see similar patterns with those around amount. And then the second is with content. And there, if they're watching educational content, which most kids don't, you know, that has beneficial effects. If they're watching violent content, that increases aggressive thoughts and feelings, which can later show up in behaviors when they're provoked.
As a parent, this is really concerning to me because I would never put a TV in my child's bedroom, but devices do get carried all over the place. And in our house, for example, you know, we have rules about how long you can watch something and when things need to be plugged in downstairs away from the bedroom. But even just that act of having your device in a private place, that's the scary thing I'm taking away from this. that's something we all need to be thinking about.
Yeah, and like I say, this is such a new thing. We don't have, you know, good data yet to know, does it have, you know, some particularly different effect. But I think what we know about how parents can monitor relates to this. And so there are several ways you can monitor your kids' media use, and the best of them in the research literature is what's called active mediation. This is where you talk to your kid about what they're seeing and hearing and why it's designed the way it is and what effect it might have on people and from whose point of view it's shown and whose point of view is it not shown, to get them to do this critical reasoning about what they're seeing. Now, most parents don't do that because they haven't been trained how to. But it turns out if you get into a habit of having these conversations about why you watch what you watch and why you don't watch what you don't watch, then when your kid goes over to Johnny's house and sees something you would never in a million years would have let them watch, they come home and they tell you about it because they're just in that habit. And you still have an opportunity to help them understand it the way you want them to. And so if you're in this habit, then when they walk into their room with a device and watch something, hopefully they're still willing to share with you what they're doing, and that communication is open so that it's not something hidden. And that's where I think most parents get worried, is, you know, thinking their kids are seeing something that they don't have an opportunity to ameliorate the effect in any way.
I want to bring up something you mentioned just briefly, video game addiction. And are you talking just about video games, or is this kind of a media addiction behavior that can be developed?
We don't know is the correct scientific answer. I've tended to study focused based on video games. The American Psychiatric Association and now the parallel organization for Europe, which is run by the World Health Organization, actually are talking about this being a gaming addiction primarily and not broad media. But that may be because we just haven't studied all the other media as carefully yet. So I think that, you know, anyone who's like me, who has a hard time not checking their email every 5 minutes, I think we feel that pull, and it feels kind of like an addiction. It does feel disruptive to other things a lot of the time. So it's possible it could be many media, but the research at this point really seems to focus most on games, or especially internet-connected games.
What would you look for in your child to see signs of a possible video game addiction? Because there's loving something and wanting to do it and maybe getting upset or throwing a tantrum when they're told they can't do it. But addiction goes so much farther than that. What are the signs?
Well, this is a really important question. We could probably spend a whole hour on it. But in short, an addiction doesn't just mean you do something a lot, and it doesn't just mean you love doing something. It means that you do it in a way that damages other areas of your life. So if kids are giving up all their friends who don't game because they only want to talk to gaming friends, or they are giving up other hobbies that they used to like and just spending their time on the games, or if their grades are dropping, these are the types of things that parents often can see. The problem with an addiction is people get good at hiding it. So one of the symptoms is lying about it. But if your kid's a good liar, you don't know. Or hiding it. I hear from many parents that, you know, their kid goes to bed at 10 like they're supposed to, and then only later do they find out that their kid also then gets up at 1 and games through the middle of the night. But if, you know, the kid's successful at hiding it, parents might not even see all the symptoms. So I think you have to look for some of these other indicators, such as a drop in school performance or a drop in interest in other things they used to be interested in.
Now, you were the lead author of this study giving us this information, Doug. It's not fair to ask you for parenting advice, but I'm going to do it anyway. So, you know, parents, when they look at this information, they want to know how to handle it, what they should do in their home. So what advice would you give parents?
Sure. Well, I think that open communication with your kids is always going to be good, and that's, you know, everyone knows that. That's so talking about these things with your kids, because the kids don't really want to be harmed by the media either. And if they start understanding why certain types of shows or certain amounts can actually hurt them, then it's a little easier for them to get on board with whatever your rules are. Having consistent rules in your house, and I don't just mean consistent across kids, but I also mean consistent between the parents, seems to matter. So, you know, kids are very good at figuring out whether mom's rules are different from dad's rules. So working this out as a family and working together to support each other's rules, I think, is important. And every family is different. Every kid is different. So there isn't a one-size-fits-all set of what the rules should be. But, and of course, as kids grow, the rules should change to fit their stage of development as well. So it's hard to give that level, but as I think we've talked about on a previous show, when parents do set limits on the amount of time kids spend with screen media and on the content, that's a powerful protective factor for kids, that those kids end up getting better grades, being more pro-social in their behaviors, less aggressive in their behaviors, less risk for obesity, things like that. And the interesting thing is that parents can't know they're having that effect, because you can only see what your kid is. You can only know that your kid is getting this grade. You can't see what grade they would have gotten if you had different rules, if you hadn't set any rules. And so parents see the fight, but they don't see the effect. And you know, what we found in our research is that the effect is profound and long-lasting, and so it's well worth setting these rules and having the fight, if you need to get the kids on board with the rules.
And if it's not too late, I'm also getting don't put the devices in their bedrooms.
Well, yeah, don't do it. And if it is too late, is it worth having the fight to take them out? It probably is. I mean, that's what this study seems to show, is that just having media in your bedroom on its own is a profound risk factor for multiple health and wellness indicators. And so taking it out, you know, don't blame the kid. It's your mistake as a parent. And maybe own up to that with your kid. You know, you didn't know that this could have a harmful effect, and you want what's best for them, and they're going to be upset with you. Yes, they are. They get to be. That's fair. But still, it's also fair for you to do what's right for their long-term wellness.
Doug Gentile, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Douglas Gentile is a professor of psychology at Iowa State University. He is the lead author of a new study that gives us insight into the consequences of allowing children to have a TV or video game system in their bedroom. The study was published in the Journal of Developmental Psychology. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.